Welt Talks.
Hi everybody, my name is Matthias Döpfner. I'm the CEO of Axel Springer, a European publisher from Berlin. More and more active these days in the United States, we own The Insider Group, Morning Brew, Politico. And it is my pleasure to talk today to Barry Weiss. Barry is a journalist born in Pittsburgh, studied at Columbia University. She used to work for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, The Forward, The Wall Street Journal. And when she left the New York Times in 2020, she wrote a famous resignation letter. Hi, Barry. Great to have you. And I would like to talk to you about journalism today and freedom, freedom of expression and future of democracy. Small topics. Why did you become a journalist?
I became a journalist because I couldn't believe that you got to get paid to pursue your curiosity and that someone that wasn't an expert in anything but was curious about so many things could, you know, get to travel and talk to people. And in a way, it was sort of monetizing the things that I naturally had, curiosity and also a bit of chutzpah.
That's funny, because when I started as a freelancer at the age of 18, I was totally surprised that I would be paid for something that I was doing out of passion and to just investigate something and write how I see things and get paid for it. What a privilege. Is that still a feeling that you have today or only in the very early days?
Oh, no, I think it's actually only deepened, especially since now I'm, you know, building my own media company, as small as it may be, especially compared to Axel Springer. But the point is that, yeah, no, that hasn't gone away at all.
Was there a kind of special moment, an epiphany, which told you that's what you should do or that encouraged you to continue to be a journalist? Or was it just...
Growing up, I mean, my parents are in the carpet and furniture business. I didn't grow up in a family where anyone was a journalist. One of my parents' friends was, and I thought it was really curious and interesting. And so that was sort of my only encounter with it, was probably this guest around our Shabbat dinner table and hearing about what he wrote about for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Fast forward to when I was at university, I went to Columbia, and I was passionate about a number of issues. Was involved a lot in the trying to expose the genocide happening in Darfur, and I was involved in standing up for Israel. I very much identified as a political progressive, but I was involved in those issues, which to me felt fundamental and still do to my Jewish identity. And I sort of realized that, you know, the contrast between the impact of standing in the middle of the Quad and holding up a poster and yelling out a slogan and trying to get people to listen to you and sway their minds that way just had such a minuscule effect compared to a column of 750 words that I wrote in the Columbia Daily Spectator. And for me, that was the original epiphany moment of, oh, wow, this is actually the way that you sway minds. And thinking also back to my own life, the things that got me to change my mind was almost never, you know, a march or a person, you know, carrying a placard. It was reading a polemical essay, or it was reading a book, or it was a deep conversation, or it was a documentary. It was things that I encountered mostly through writing, but also sometimes through a visual medium. And so that to me was the beginning of, oh, wow, here is a way for me to move the world in some small way that actually feels... it's effective, if that makes sense.
Na, schon die Steuererklärung gemacht? Wir vom Handelsblatt haben in einem Steuerspezial analysiert, worauf das Finanzamt bei der Steuer 2023 genauer guckt. In unserem PDF-Ratgeber finden Sie die wichtigsten 16 Neuerungen, Einstiegstipps für Elster und 4 Wege, wie Sie das Maximum herausholen. Sichern Sie sich also jetzt das digitale Handelsblatt 4 Wochen für nur 1 Euro unter handelsblatt.com/mehrwissen.
You mentioned that your parents were in the furniture business, Weiss House. Was it nevertheless a politicized childhood, or was politics something that you discovered entirely for yourself?
Oh, no, it was very much the context that I grew up in. My dad entered university as a Maoist and left as a neocon. He had Straussian professors at this little school he went to. So he was sort of a lifelong bleeding heart conservative, I would say. And my mom, a liberal. And so I grew up very much in a politically mixed home. And especially my dad, once he sort of became conservative, became, in a loving way, the black sheep of his family. So he was always, you know, calling his mother a communist, my grandmother, and they were always sort of lovingly screaming and arguing at each other. So for me, you know, and this is just so foreign to me how much this has changed among the younger generation, where it feels almost dangerous to be around people with different views. For me, it feels unbelievably stimulating and in fact feels like home. And that's very much what my wife and I pride ourselves on doing in our own home. So yeah, I was always sort of talking about politics, but like anything when you're growing up, you don't really realize the context and the unique context that you have until you make your way in the world. And it was only as I made my way in the world that I realized, oh, wow, most people have parents that really agree with each other. And most people have families where they don't talk about politics all the time. And we very much did. You know, it's really a credit to the way that I grew up, I think, that I'm comfortable disagreeing with people. And frankly, I think that makes me, and I'm a much better editor than I am a writer, that makes me a very good op-ed editor. I like strengthening and sharpening the argument of people that disagree with me.
Would you consider yourself a conservative, or would you consider yourself in opposition to your conservative father?
That's the question that I'm constantly getting right now, because the world has changed so much. And I feel like to be a conservative means you want to conserve liberalism. And if that's what a conservative is right now, I guess I am one. But I think of myself, and I've taken 100 million online polls, and if you just look down at the sort of list of issues, I'm consistently someone who is on the center or center left. But because what's at stake right now in America, and you'll tell me if this is the case in Germany, is not really policies per se. It's questions about the bedrock of liberalism. It's questions about sort of like the bedrock of liberal democracy. Well, yes, I am very much not with the radicals on the far right who say liberalism is dead. It's what got us to this juncture. Or with those on the left that say, you know, because the founding documents of my country were written by the hands of people that owned slaves, that they need to be torn down. I am not for revolution. I think revolution is something that is intoxicating to people and leads to tremendous bloodshed. And one of the things that worries me so much about what's happening in America right now is the fact that those views seem like they are ascendant ones. And the center and the people who are wanting to conserve the very values that allow us to disagree in the first place has sort of collapsed.
I like the idea that a conservative wants to protect liberalism and freedom. You said you're against revolutions, but you could also acknowledge that it needs reforms. So I would make the case I'm a progressive who wants to preserve liberalism and wants to preserve freedom and freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. So I think that can come from both directions. But would you say that at the moment, in the current zeitgeist, liberalism and free expression is threatened?
That's the reason that I'm talking to you, you know, in my house with a ring light and a microphone jigged up in front of a guest bed rather than, you know, being in the office of the New York Times. I mean, of course, that's...
I'm not asking whether it's declining. I'm seriously asking whether it's threatened. So in a way that it could really go away. That a free and open society like the United States or like Europe could transform into autocratic mentality where this fundament of democracy and open society is not given any longer. Would you go that far? Sounds a bit exaggerated to me, honestly, just to provoke you. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that that's imminent in the same way that, you know, I was on Bill Maher the other night and the opening guest was talking about how we're basically, you know, on the slippery slope toward fascism. I don't believe that either.
And you said, I'm done with COVID. I heard that.
Well, I am.
I heard that this morning.
Yeah, I think most people are done with COVID. Most people, by that, I mean, I'm done with draconian restrictions that are theater. In the same way that I think it's ridiculous that I have to take my shoes off every time I walk through an airport because Richard Reed tried to blow up his shoe one time 20 years ago. I mean, it's at this point, it's theatrical. It's not based on the science, especially based on the data we've known over the past 2 years. But anyway, we can do COVID too. But to your question, Look, I think that if I'm a fatalist, I would say that no culture, no regime, no society lasts forever. That's just reality. And the things, we know this, the things that, if we just look at history, that preserve good things or preserve anything is really will and whether or not people are willing to sacrifice for the sake of a certain set of virtues or a certain culture or a certain whatever, certain country. And the thing that is so worrisome to me is like, I just don't see that will. I don't see people making the case, especially to the younger generation in America, that no, we are exceptional. And these things that we believe are worth not just fighting for, but maybe even sacrificing for. It's almost crazy. Like my friend Caitlin Flanagan, the writer, was tweeting, you know, JFK's famous line the other day. That's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. It's like, I can't even imagine an American leader saying a phrase like that these days.
I mean, freedom is threatened, you could say, from two directions. On the one hand, the autocratic systems, the totalitarian systems that are gaining ground these days. And on the other hand, the kind of self-weakening of centrist democracies by, in a way, more and more compromising with certain rules and expectations that these authoritarian systems expose. And at the same time, also by giving in, if it is about our own standards of freedom, of discussion, diversity of views. Which brings us back to the role of journalism. I always thought that the role of journalism is to put up for discussion very different facts, results of investigative work, news, and also views. And you have experienced something that led to your departure from the New York Times that sounds pretty different. What I try to find out is it certain worry about quality and self-definition of good journalism? Or is it really going beyond that? And are you seriously worried that that could lead to a system change almost in Western societies?
Wow. That's a huge question. I'll answer it and then you'll tell me if this is what you're looking for. I think what's going on...
I'm an open-minded journalist who doesn't know what I want to hear from you. It's just I tried to find out.
Are you interested in the times? Or are you interested in like the shift that...
Beyond the times, beyond the times. I mean, I don't want to have an insider talk with you about the situation at the times. Other people can do that, I think. Would be more interesting to get your view on the bigger picture. And I think the experience that you made at the times is just a symptom for that, perhaps. And if you could go beyond that, that would be beautiful.
Yeah, I think what's going on is the what someone has termed audience capture. In other words, if you are an editor, reporter at the New York Times, or you could say the same thing about Fox or MSNBC, it's very clear who your audience is. And it's overwhelmingly, in those three examples, people from one particular side of the political spectrum. And because the people that are the constituency that's paying the bills in the end of the day is no longer the advertisers, it's the subscribers. You are incentivized, and this is not like a conspiracy, it's just the laws of economics, to feed that audience more of what they want. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise, I guess, that if you turn on Fox at night, they're going to be talking about how America's sliding into communism. But if you turn on NBC, they're going to be talking about how we're sliding into fascism. This problem, right, of sort of feeding the audience political heroin rather than doing what you just described, which is called being an editor and curating the world as you see it for your audience so that they can make an educated and informed decision about actual things in the world. That is under threat if you're the publisher of the New York Times, if you're the head of Fox, or even if you're like me and you're running a Substack. And the reason for that is because of the new economic model that I don't see anyone has sort of found a way around yet. But I'm curious if in Germany it's different or if you sort of feel like the reason people are picking up Die Welt or any of these other newspapers is because people are saying to themselves, I don't want that political heroin. And if so, how have you trained your readers to understand that that's the better option.
I think we have two phenomenons here that are related. And in general, we have the same undercurrents or the same trends in Europe, I would say, than in the United States. And that is polarization, that more and more media brands think that they have to be in one camp and that they, with that, in a way, amplify prejudice of their audience.
Yes.
Instead of confronting them with opposing views in order to complicate the worldview in a very healthy sense, because reality may be sometimes, and in most of the cases, a bit more complicated than the obvious prejudice. So that is one trend, the polarization, media brands in political camps. I think pretty much the opposite of what journalism should do or should be. And the other thing is, and that is almost a generational phenomenon that I observe, that more and more younger journalists don't draw a line, a clear line between journalism and activism.
Yes.
And very often I have also discussions here in Germany with young journalists who have very, very good intentions. But basically what they're saying, if it is for a good cause,
right,
the good cause is more important than contradictory facts. If it is for climate change, if it's against racism, if it is against the abusive forms of capitalism, then I should take the intention,
that's right,
as a legitimacy for, yeah, ignoring certain facts that could weaken the theory. And that is another, I think, structural enemy of good journalism. And these phenomenons, activism and polarization, come together. And I think that is the big challenge. I would then have an optimistic position here and say, if the world of media is polarizing, and if more and more journalists see themselves as activists, those who do differently, who really stick to the principle of open-ended investigation,
that's right,
of nonpartisan reporting, of diversity of views, even provocative views, and a clear distinction between activism and journalism, that I think is then the big opportunity for those. So I think, yeah, there will be a counterwave.
That's my bet. I want to say two things in response to it. One is the polarization, or as I think about it, like, are you participating in the radicalization of your readers, right? And I know on my Substack, if I run a piece every other day about the excesses of wokeness or cancel culture, I'll see my subscriber numbers go up. Up. But it's up on me, or it's on any publisher, no matter how small or how big, to say, no, I don't want to do the thing that I have so criticized. I don't want to participate in what so many other outlets are doing, which is radicalizing my reader.
But it is a seductive experience, huh? So because it shows you if you're doing that.
Exactly. But
the numbers go up.
You have to resist seduction. Just like you resist it.
I give you a rational reason why it is smart to do so. And here I could refer to concrete experiences that your former employer made. If your readership is expecting something very specific from you and you don't deliver on that, perhaps because the truth just is a bit more complex, or because you have one different view in your journalistic team, then you get punished.
Right.
And that punishment can lead to a situation where you as a publisher, you as a media brand, you as a journalist are almost dependent on...
You're a hostage.
You're a hostage of your readers. That's exactly what I wanted to say.
Yes. And I think that there's two things I want to say in response to that. One is that I think the whole challenge right now, especially for people building new things into this sort of huge opportunity that's open, is you have to resist short-term benefit for the sake of building long-term trust. You have to. Because if you can build that long-term trust, in the end, that's going to be so much more valuable than the spike in readers you get from running XYZ thing you know they'll expect. The other thing I was going to say regarding the way that young journalists fundamentally have a different understanding of what journalism is supposed to be about, sort of are uncomfortable with stories that might encourage the alternative view or might down the line stoke some kind of nefariousness or bigotry or whatever their idea is. There was such a potent example where my wife, who has since left the Times, we met there, she, in the wake of the summer of 2020, went to Kenosha, Wisconsin. And she reported on the absolute destruction that that had happened there and in so many other communities. And right, this was around the time, it feels like a million years ago, where you were only allowed to say that they were peaceful protests. You were not allowed to use the word riots. And the reaction on the part of the newspaper was, let's not run this right now. Let's, even though all of the people she was reporting on were minorities, minority business owners, none of that mattered. What mattered was the maintenance of the narrative. And once your job as a journalist or an outlet becomes the maintenance of the narrative, you know that you are now in the business of marketing and PR for a cause.
Do you see a trend in the United States too that I observe in Europe, that more and more people are saying journalism has to be constructive, journalism has to help, that a project is going to prevail, certain idea is going to prevail? So this idea of constructive journalism, I find it very irritating, I have to say. I always thought journalism is asking unpleasant questions and showing the other side of the coin, turning things around upside down, being controversial, but not being constructive. What is your observation in the States, and what is your personal take on that?
Look, I think there's a spectrum, right? There are certain things that are so explicit, it's almost propagandistic. And there's an audience for it, and it's a business. It's just not the business I want to be in. And I wouldn't call that business journalism. That said, I think it's a bit of a, I think it's a fib to claim that I personally don't have a worldview. And I would imagine Axel Springer has a worldview to some extent. I mean, that worldview is summed up, as we were talking about before this began, in The Essentials. That
Absolutely.
Is a view. Right? And that is a view that used to be, maybe 20 years ago, a consensus view in Germany and is now perhaps more under siege than it once was. I believe in journalism for the pursuit of telling the truth. But why do I want to tell the truth? I want to tell the truth because I think that telling the truth is essential for the health of a liberal democracy. And I believe in that thing. So yes, that's a view. It's different than saying, you know, something like, I only want to publish stories that promote, you know, the Me Too movement or whatever. And that's what you see all over the place these days.
And I think that's the difference, exactly the difference between activism, that is fighting for a good cause, and journalism that has views and principles and ethos, but is in a way open-ended in investigation and open-ended in its conclusions. And then we can discuss transparency. You mentioned the Axel Springer Essentials. Yeah, it's a bit like a constitution. And sometimes I get the feedback, but how can you say that? How can you make that kind of constitutional declaration? You have to be totally neutral. And here's my point. I think neutral journalism doesn't exist. That's already a lie to say there's neutral journalism, because
That's
always
right.
human beings who are making decisions. That's why I think to be very transparent and say, what are our fundamental values, which is in our case that we stand up for freedom, for the rule of law, for democracy, and that we support the Jewish people and the right of existence of the State of Israel, that we advocate the Transatlantic Alliance, and we uphold principles of a free market economy, and that we reject political and religious extremism and all forms of racism and sexual discrimination. That is our constitution. Those are our values. But within that values, there's so much room to criticize the American government, to criticize the settlement policy in Israel, to criticize certain excesses of bad capitalism, and so on. So it doesn't mean that you are biased. It's just transparency about your fundamental values. But within that framework, you have to be unpredictable. Let's say you have to be the voice that is asking the unpleasant questions and not the voice that tries to be constructive in order to push a certain agenda through.
I think The Essentials are really brilliant, actually. And I, as I myself am going out to sort of hire people, do we share a worldview? Do we share, I don't mean a political worldview, do we share a common set of values? And I looked at The Essentials and I was like, wow, that's it's excellent. And I have wanted to ask you, you know, one of the things that's a challenge with legacy institutions like the New York Times, but it's not the New York Times, it's everywhere now, is, you know, the 25, 26-year-old that you were referring to before, who has a fundamentally different understanding of what the role of a journalist is. Do you find that The Essentials help sort of self-select, help weed out people who, you know, aren't the right fit, or no?
Totally, totally. I think, first of all, we have a very lively discussion about it. And it is not that we basically, in an authoritarian way, expect that everybody who wants to join our company, work for us, just signs it and agrees on it. This lively discussion is important. Second point, not everybody agrees that if there's too much fundamental disagreement. So if somebody fundamentally thinks that free market economy and the United States of America are symbols of evil, then we have an issue. And then there's perhaps a better company for that person to work for. If somebody has an issue that we say the right of existence of Israel is particularly important for us as a German company, in a way living in the legacy of a country that has organized the Holocaust, that the mentioning of that special responsibility is important for us. If somebody has an issue here, there are also other and better companies to work for. But for those who then decide in all transparency and after these discussions, this is the right place for me, in that kind of nonpartisan spirit that I'm not supporting constructively any agenda, but that I'm just complying with certain underlying values, then I think these essentials can have a very motivating aspect. I think it is even more motivating for a lot of people to work for us than a big good stock option program or something like that.
Once I saw those essentials, I remember a few months ago, they became a subject of discussion in the press. I don't remember exactly why. But it inspired me to sit down and sort of write my own. So thanks.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea because it clarifies things. Yeah,
it does.
You have that. Yeah, for you and for everybody who's joining you and working for you. Yeah,
that's right.
Ari, I was impressed to read when you said you have a kind of litmus test, and the litmus test has three elements about a free and open society. You want to be able to walk down a street with a tank top. You want to be able to walk down a street with your wife without being kind of strangely watched. And you want to be able to wear the Star of David without
fear.
Fear. Exactly. Where are we if you walk along the streets of New York these days?
It's funny. My wife recently started wearing a Magen David, a Jewish star. And listen, cities right now in America are sort of full, as you may have heard, of sort of rising crime, vagrant population. And someone said something horrible to her. And she called me and said, did my first anti-Semitism happen to me? Or was it just a crazy guy? And I said, I didn't know. Listen, I would say that the reason that those litmus tests are so important is because oftentimes, as you know, there's sort of like this histrionic quality to conversation about America, that it's horrible, that it's becoming authoritarian, that it's fascist, that democracy's over. And I sort of have to kind of make it real for people. You know, would you rather be a Jewish gay woman or a minority in most other places in the world? Or is this kind of the best out there? And it kind of puts, it sort of clarifies, I think, often in a conversation, you know, are you looking for good enough and always improving? Or are you looking for utopia? Because if you're looking for utopia, you're never going to find it in politics.
I totally agree. You know, my point would be, it is a very good sign of a healthy society and healthy journalistic instincts to focus on the things that are not going well enough and the things that should be improved. And fierce criticism in that context is, I think, most welcome and absolutely needed. At the same time, we may not put things on the same level that are not comparable. And if I hear people saying, well, you know, the United States of America under this or that president, that's worse than Putin, or it's worse than Xi in China. They have a secret service. We have a secret service. They have nuclear bombs. We have nuclear bombs. Sorry, that is comparing the uncomparable. And we have to make a very clear distinction. We are living in a very imperfect democracy in Europe and in America, but this is so much better. And I really get up every morning to defend that than any autocratic system and any leader where there's no rule of law, where there's no freedom of expression, where fundamental human rights are not given. And let's not put that on the same comparison level. It is uncomparable.
I could not agree with you more. And one of the subjects that we are writing about constantly and that I'm just paying such close attention to is this, frankly, despicable false moral equivalency that people are drawing between China often and the U.S. and a kind of, first of all, a kind of grotesque veneration of the orderliness of China or what they've been able to accomplish. Well, sure, you know, that's what's going to happen when you have central planning, but also a sense of, you know, who this moral relativism that frankly I encountered when I was a freshman at university, you know, that I thought should remain there because it's an argument for 19-year-olds to have, you know, oh yes, women are oppressed here. And, you know, there's female genital mutilation over there, half a dozen of one. No, I'm sorry. There are certain things that are just not comparable, as you just said. And the notion that, you know, because we have domestic problems here at home, that somehow that sort of puts, let's say, the genocide of the Uyghurs into context, it's reprehensible. And the extent to which that view has become normalized among business, tech, and sometimes even political elites in this country is really alarming to me.
I could not agree more. It is, I think, incredibly important, particularly these days, because what we see in the Middle East, what we see in China, what we see in Russia, which is very concrete, particularly to European these days, given the situation in Ukraine, that shows us what the consequence of that relativism is. And people then are saying, well, I don't want to engage. You know, we have also some imperfect elements on our side. That's not the point. I rather live in a non-perfect democracy and be able to criticize it every day than living in a perfect dictatorship where it looks better because nobody is allowed to criticize. Well, if you take the Middle East conflict, Israel is not a role model if it is about human rights and so on. I don't know. You know, if in Israel a president is sexually harassing a staff member, he ends up in jail. If in one of his neighbor countries, the president is raping a woman and she accuses him to have done that, she is getting stoned. She is getting stoned. That is the difference. Yeah. Okay, I think we agree on that. So perhaps let's really briefly move to COVID. I was impressed by your kind of very emotional statement. I'm done with COVID, and you criticized some inconsistencies. I would like to go back to journalism. How did journalism develop during the pandemic? What is your assessment here?
I've been thinking a lot about that recently, and I sometimes wonder if we hadn't sort of all gone into our holes or our homes, rather, and been only interacting with our peers through the screen that we're talking through right now, I wonder if really any of the past 2 years would have happened. In other words, when you're in a newsroom with someone, and this is a comment also just about online life versus IRL life, you know, and you're bumping up against people who disagree with you, you're still forced to contend with the fact that that's a human being in front of you. And I do think that only interacting, we used a platform called Slack, but you know, it could be GChat or anything. When you're only interacting with people through that medium or Twitter, it's very easy to sort of dehumanize people that you disagree with. And I think part of the reason that there was just such a contentious few years is because of work from home. It was because of the fact that people were no longer forced to go into a newsroom and look at their peers in the eye and maybe have a drink at the end of the day. And so as much as journalism in certain ways is a solitary profession, I do think that it's essential to kind of interact with people, especially if you're trying to build the kind of newsroom or company that you and I have been talking about, where you can disagree with your peers and it can be okay. The other thing that I think happened, and this is not just to do with journalism, it's to do with the country, and maybe Germany is different, the division between sort of like the Amazon coalition and the people that can order their stuff and be inside the laptop class, as we've been called, and I'm absolutely part of that group, and the people who deliver your stuff in the rain or in the snow, the people that build the cardboard boxes to get it to you, that division has become a chasm in this country. And I do think that there is a major issue with the laptop class being profoundly out of touch with the people that are not in that class and what the past 2 years have been like for them. And one of the things that I've prided myself on, and we're about to do some more stories about it, is really talking to the parents of, for example, public school children who have had to be home, let's say with four siblings in a house sharing one tablet over the past 2 years, and the catastrophe, the moral catastrophe that it has been for those kids. It is one thing if you are able, if your parents work from home at a laptop and you're able to afford to send your kids into a special pod or private school. But what if you're not? And that's what I was trying to bring out on the Bill Maher show and in general is what has the cost been to those kind of families?
But if we look to the effect that the pandemic had to digital journalism, which is the journalism of today and the journalism of the future, because of the remaining analog legacy brands will disappear, I think, then we have to admit that COVID was actually pretty positive for reach developments, subscription of digital journalism, because, first of all, people needed trustful information. And it was more relevant than ever. You could say it was almost existential. And secondly, everybody was willing to consume that online because that's simply healthier and more practical than going to a newsstand and get a paper. So that is, I think you could say, transforming moment for the future of digital journalism. The question that I have and where I'm less perhaps optimistic is to which degree the role of journalism as a critical element in a public debate has developed in the right direction. At least in Europe, we observed here and there, and in some countries more and others less, that also here journalists try to be constructive, try to save lives, try to get official government information across. Is that something that could have an impact and could change the role and self-definition of journalism in the long run? Or would you say that's something that is going to go when the pandemic transformed into an endemic and we live with it?
Well, it's a good question because when I see, for example, that I'm still looking at the case numbers, not hospitalization numbers, but case numbers of certain outlets, I'm like, is that the most relevant information that I need right now? Or have you become addicted to sort of public service journalism? I don't know. I mean, listen, this was a historic pandemic. There's going to be another one, or there will be something else that will call for this kind of emergency. And I wonder, or that will sort of be this level of urgency and a feeling of, you know, public health is at stake, public safety is at stake. And the question is, like, will journalists, it's your question, will journalists be able to have a kind of role that is critically distant? I was struck, and I'm sure you know more about this paper than I do. There was a Danish tabloid that apologized the other day.
Right.
The editorial was just called, "We're Sorry." And I was very struck by that. And I wonder if there's going to be more apologies of, you know, we didn't maintain the critical distance that is our role in a democracy. And we're still in it, so I just don't know yet.
No, but that is one of the examples. There are some more, and that is in a way leading me to this kind of fundamental, perhaps final question about changes beyond journalism, whether dealing with the pandemic, trying to manage the COVID crisis has weakened individual rights, has weakened individual freedom,
yes,
has weakened constitutional rights. And what is that going to change and to do in the long run? You could even say health and freedom are to a certain point contradictory.
That's right.
Absolute health you achieve with very significant limitation of freedom.
Absolute authoritarianism.
Absolute
exactly.
authoritarianism and is the healthiest
that's
thing.
That's right. Yeah. I am sort of wondering at this point, like, is the goal COVID zero? Is the goal that no one tests positive after every adult, at least in this country, has had access to a vaccine for a year? The thing that has... And I'm going to write a piece about this. I haven't found a way yet. Naively, and this is, I think, one of the main things that has shifted for me during this pandemic. I thought human beings loved freedom over safety. And I am increasingly aware of the fact that, no, most people really, really are comfortable with what to my mind are incredibly draconian and authoritarian measures for the sake of safety. And they are willing to go along with the hurt in a way that I find alarming. That's been my big revelation over the past 2 years is why are more people not disturbed by the idea of having to, you know, and by the way, I'm compliant. I'm someone that's gone along with all of it because I don't want to, you know, I know someone's just doing their job at a restaurant. I don't know. There's a way in which we've sort of sleptwalked into this new reality with not a lot of resistance. Do I sound crazy when I say that?
No, unfortunately not. I have to say that what you have just said is quite a scary concluding remark of our conversation. And I see the danger that the priority of safety could be the winner of the pandemic, and the big sacrifice of our societies would be freedom. That is what you have described as your biggest fear. I share that fear. But Barry, I have to tell you, I really wish that your fear or our fear is entirely wrong. And perhaps good journalism can help that this dystopian vision is not coming true.
I'll add one thing, which is one of the things I think is so important, especially as people have been sort of isolated from one another. You have a sense of, as I just asked you, do I sound crazy? That's the question that a lot of people are asking themselves. When their views are not reflected in the mainstream, they're thinking to themselves, am I crazy? Am I alone in this? Or do other people share the same sense, the same visceral fear that I have? One of the things that great journalism can do in this moment, and that I'm really trying to do, is to hold up a mirror and say, look at all of these other people that are thinking the way that you're thinking. You're not alone. And you're not crazy. In fact, the world has gone a little crazy. And I think that that is an important role that journalism can play, especially in a time where people have been so isolated from one another.
Barry, thank you very much. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.